I grew up kind of exposed to a lot of the residual and leftover imagery of like older futures, and being educated as a designer and a little bit as a researcher kind of gave me the tools to go back and ask these questions about, you know, what was all that anyway? What was that? What was it intended to be? And then what kind of happened to it? So what may have started out as a kind of, you know, simplistically a retro futurist nostalgia trip turned into kind of a critical journey. I'm Fred Sharman. I teach architecture and urban design at Morgan State University, and I'm the author of Space Settlements. In beginning to track down some of this stuff, I got really specifically interested in these images that were about possible human futures in outer space, projected from the 1970s, you know, would have been happening about now in the early 21st century. And they kept showing these same forms. And I'm really interested in like, what are these sort of elemental forms that these design objects are taking again and again? And eventually I found out that the core kind of artifacts that a lot of this futurist speculation were based on had been designed by people working with NASA in a conference that they called a summer study. And in particular, this one in 75, they brought in architects and urban designers to work alongside the engineers and physicists to design what were essentially large-scale cities in space. NASA, in the mid-1970s, started to look around, I think, for big-picture plans that would define a trajectory or a set of scenarios that they could follow after the end of the Apollo program. This is before the space shuttle program had really kicked off. That was on the boards, but no shuttle flew until, I think, 1981. So one of the things they were interested in looking at as part of one of these summer studies was Gerard O'Neill's ideas. Gerard O'Neill was a physicist who was teaching at Princeton when he was assigned to teach a freshman physics course. One of the first questions that he posed in this class is the surface of the planet really the right place for an expanding technological civilization? And so that became the genesis for O'Neill's interest in creating large-scale habitats that would be away from Earth and not on any other planet either. So not on the surface of the moon or not on Mars, free-floating and spinning for artificial gravity. His research on these habitats had been published in a few places already and were starting to get traction. But they offered him the chance to go in deep with teams of specialists on all those aspects of the problem of large-scale living in outer space. Where the materials come from, how do you design the habitats, what even is the nature of social life or governance or economies in these new places. Of course, if you get a bunch of people together, each of whom has their own background, their own specialties, and you ask them, what is a world, you're going to get a bunch of different answers. Gerard O'Neill thought of a world as a place where I think anyone could have the freedom to construct a lifestyle on their own terms. He was a hang glider. He was a failed astronaut candidate, you know, and certainly there's no disgrace in being a failed astronaut candidate. I'm a failed astronaut candidate, right? I mean, how many people wanted to be astronauts? And so one of the ways that bias, I think, shows up in the way he struggled to manage the project was that he wanted to create a habitat that had an open center. So at the center of these large rotating objects, a mile or more in diameter, there would be zero gravity. There'd be gravity at the rim because of the rotation and centrifugal forces. But in the middle, you could float free. And this, I think, is one of the core kind of unexamined values in O'Neill's own impulses that was at odds with the engineering cultures that he was bringing on board. Materials engineers might say, well, for maximum efficiency in terms of usable area, a sphere with an open center is not so great because we have to heat and cool all this extra atmosphere, and all the usable land is essentially a big valley, which is harder to build on. So they wanted to build a large torus instead, like a big spinning bicycle wheel. NASA hired two painters, Don Davis and Rick Goodis, that had this really interesting set of intersectional backgrounds in architecture, in planetary science illustration, in illustrating science fiction book covers and things like that. And they were brought in to show what these worlds might be like. But they exercised their own imagination in no small part as they fleshed out those engineering details into visions of real places. So what they ended up producing is this kind of, I think of it as almost an accidental canon of 13 images. They're effectively in the public domain, so that's what's enabled them to show up again and again in so many ways in popular culture. This is my favorite one. So what I'm looking at is a painting by Rick Goodis that shows the interior of one of the three design case studies they made called the Bernal Sphere. And this is, of course, O'Neill's preferred version of the habitat. This was going to be a place for 10,000 people to live in, and it was going to be about a mile in diameter, rotating so that at its outermost circumference, there was the equivalent of one Earth gravity. But again, in the center, there's free space for recreation, flight. There actually is a hang glider showing up in the painting. The other thing that I think is notable about this painting is that we're seeing the view from a high position. So we have a broad landscape literally laid out and wrapped around us. And there's probably more green space, planted space, than there is built space. And there's this mix of contemporary, or what would have been contemporary architecture from the 1970s, and little traditional details like houses with gabled roofs, which of course wouldn't be necessary because there's no clouds or rain that's going to form inside this habitat. But the best part is this cocktail party that's taking place in the foreground. There's a spectacular view, but no one in the party, and there's about maybe 10 figures here, is looking at the view at all. They're all talking to each other, laughing and joking. They're obviously like over it. You know, they live here. This is part of their daily experience. They're there to be with one another, not to appreciate this crazy, fantastical place that they live in. And they're a really diverse group of people. Since there's no history, there is the assumption or the hope that the fraught past, a very recent past in the mid-1970s, of racial conflict in the United States and racial injustice could be also left behind along with gravity. There is the kind of the easy visual punchline of showing something like the Stanford Torus, which is a giant ring next to the new Apple campus by Foster and Partners, which is also a giant ring. But they have a lot of organizational modes in common as well. Each of these is a habitat designed to provide almost everything that a human might need so that you never have to leave. Also, you know, I think technology companies in general are invested in closed ecosystems in the broad sense. Apple, they want you to use an Apple mouse, they want you to use an Apple TV, and they make that system in a way that the conjunction between the parts is as seamless and pleasant as possible to the user. But even beyond that, you can see the growing impulse on the part of these technology companies to get involved with literal urban design, to create smart cities. That is directly transferable to the impulse to make complete worlds. And the broader implications of that are more dystopian maybe than utopian. Professionals working in architecture have a responsibility to health, safety, and welfare of the users. So if you're designing something and it turns out to be a fire trap, right, then you're directly responsible for any lives that are lost. How does that translate to a large scale in which a designed and built object is responsible for the lives of 10,000 people? There's a critical distance that comes into play, but there's also a kind of collapse of that critical distance when I think about the professional and even moral obligations that design has to users, and how, again, projects like this takes those questions and turns the volume up on them to 11. So they're completely unavoidable now. And when I think about any kind of future that involves space settlement or large-scale, long-term human habitation of space, I think the only certainty is that millions of people will die. Because there's no way anybody will get it right the first time. We didn't get buildings right the first time, we didn't get cities right the first time, but at least, you know, the people fleeing those dying cities were still fleeing in an atmosphere. And that won't be the case here. if I can spin that back to an optimistic mode, in the Outer Space Treaty that the United States is a signatory to, there's a provision that is the right of rescue and return. So that provision acknowledges that people in space become certain kinds of moral actors just by virtue of being in this dangerous environment. So if you or I are a person in space and one of us is in mortal danger and the other of us has the capacity to rescue that person, they have to execute that capacity. So maybe that kind of urgency that the dangers of living in outer space foregrounds can be transferable to a general moral urgency that is necessary to deal with something like a climate crisis on Earth, because Earth also has no outside.
Fred Charman's book, Space Settlements, is out now from Columbia Books on Architecture and the City. Go to thinkbelt.org/interstitial for further reading. Sign up for our newsletter while you're there. New things in 2020. Get Interstitial wherever you listen to podcasts. Share the show. Tell a friend. Sound design for Interstitial, as always, is by Sam Clapp. I'm David Huber. More next week.